Well, I can't remember whether it was my last year in primary school or the one before that, but it was the first football match of the season, and we were playing a school from another village nearby on their very slopey pitch, and the final score was 2-2, and I scored both our team's goals. And the next day then, everyone at school was talking quite a bit about my goal-scoring heroics, and I rather enjoyed all this attention, and I began to feel like I'd really hit the big time. And the game, I think, had been on a Monday, and on the Wednesday after school, it was our weekly training session. And so I turned up at it, expecting that there too a great fuss would be made of me, and the focus would be on me and my stellar performance a couple of days earlier. But at that training session, the headmaster, who was also the football coach, he did something which I'm sure was very deliberate and was also very wise. He focused throughout the session on properly bringing the ball under control, and he said that we weren't doing it well enough in that game on the Monday afternoon, and he then singled me out and said something like, Dan, or Daniel as I was always called back then, there are a few times in the game when you didn't control the ball very well. It was the only time he mentioned me throughout the whole training session. No reference to my two goals, no reference to me saving our team from defeat, just my failure to control the ball properly on several occasions. Well, I can tell you that that training session, it burst that silly self-congratulatory bubble that I've been living in for 2 days. And like Mr. Chalton then at Calton Minyard Primary School, God knows how to bring us down to earth at those times when that's necessary in our lives. You think of Paul and how he has those mysterious heavenly experiences, and they could have really gone to his head. But he says, doesn't he, in 2 Corinthians 12:7, to keep me from becoming conceited, a thorn was given me in the flesh. In a similar vein, I remember hearing Don Carson being interviewed at Keswick a few years ago. And the interviewer said to him, Don, you're massively in demand as a conference speaker. You address large audiences all over the world. How do you cope with that kind of popularity? And Carson gave a one-sentence answer, which he didn't elaborate on, but which he spoke with such feeling that you could tell he meant it. He said, I can assure you, God has his ways of keeping me humble. And I wonder whether that to which Paul testified then in 2 Corinthians 12 and that to which Don Carson testified in that interview, I wonder whether that is being experienced somewhat by Daniel here in our passage this evening. Remember how on 3 occasions Daniel has been an interpreter. He has interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's first dream about the statue. He has interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's second dream about the tree. He has interpreted the writing on the wall at Belshazzar's feast. What a gift this was Daniel had. No one else in Babylon had anything remotely comparable. You remember how the professional magicians, they just couldn't compete with Daniel in this area. You remember how Belshazzar's mother raved about Daniel's unique capabilities. And for all that he acknowledged God's enabling when giving these interpretations, Daniel could still, somewhere in the recesses of his heart, have felt good about himself, couldn't he? That he was the man that they always called for whenever there was a vision to interpret. Well, if that was the case, if there was a touch of hubris in Daniel, it takes quite a knock in our passage this evening, because here in chapter 7, Daniel himself has a vision. And as a reader, then you're thinking, well, at least on this occasion, we're not going to have that usual bewilderment phase in between the vision itself and the interpretation being given of the vision. This time, that stage in the process won't be there, because the vision's recipient, he will provide the interpretation. It's Daniel, after all, who's receiving the vision. That's what you're thinking, but that's not how it turns out, is it? Instead, you come to verse 15, and this is what it says, as for me, Daniel, My spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. It sounds a bit like Nebuchadnezzar speaking again from earlier on. I approached one of those who stood there, presumably one of the attendants around the throne in the vision that are mentioned in verse 10, and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. It's remarkable. The great interpreter needs an interpreter. And perhaps then, as I say, this is God keeping Daniel humble. And you know, I think we should thank God when he does that kind of thing. Yes, we have a God who can gift us at certain moments to do extraordinary things beyond our natural capabilities. Perhaps some of us have experienced that, and that, of course, is a wonderful thing. But we also have a God who, at times for our good, will leave us impotent and floundering, as Daniel was suddenly left impotent and floundering here, unable to interpret his own vision. And that's actually a wonderful thing as well. But we must move on and think about this vision itself then. And what I want us to do is this. I want us to take as our entry point into the vision a detail that we could easily miss. It isn't found in some obscure corner of the vision. It's in one of the more famous sections. But nonetheless, we could easily miss it. In verses 9 and 10, we're shown into heaven and we see God. And we're told about God's appearance, this emphasis on whiteness, probably representing purity. And we're told about God's throne, this kind of chariot throne with wheels. And we're told about God's attendants, presumably angelic creatures, these thousands upon thousands standing around him. But there's also something else of which we're told here. At the beginning of verse 10, a stream of fire issued and came out from before him. It's literally in the Hebrew actually a river of fire. Striking image, a river of fire issuing from before the throne of God. And you don't need me to tell you then that often in the Bible, fire has associations of judgment. We touched last Sunday morning on that, on the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels, mentioned by Jesus in Matthew 25. Or even closer to the imagery here, of course, is Revelation 20, where it's not a river of fire, but it is a lake of fire. And that's judgment. It's into that that Satan is finally cast. Now, I've preached through Revelation in the past, and that of course is a similar style of literature to what we have in these parts of Daniel. And I've said that we must be wary of pressing little pictorial details for too much significance, too much meaning. Well, is that pertinent then with regard to this? Should we just kind of pass over this river of fire in verse 10? Is it just an incidental throwaway little touch? Well, I don't think it is. I think, in fact, that this judgment fire streaming from God's throne here, it kind of holds together this entire vision. And there are three things, then, I particularly want us to notice. And first of all, the fire disguised. The fire disguised. Now, a big feature, of course, of this vision is the four beasts that we encounter in verses 1 to 8 and that are then described or explained later on. And it's pretty clear, isn't it, from the chapter what these four beasts represent. Okay, there's a little bit of ambiguity because in verse 17 we're told these four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But then you go to verse 23 and we read, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth which shall be different from all the kingdoms. So there's a little bit of ambiguity between king and kingdom, but it's hardly a big difference in meaning. Now, you may remember then that in relation to Nebuchadnezzar's statue, I don't mean the statue that he actually erected on the plain there for people to worship, I mean the statue he saw in his dream in chapter 2, you may remember that there too, in that dream, kingdoms were represented. different parts of that statue were different earthly kingdoms. And you may remember too that I was reluctant when preaching on Daniel 2 to be too specific about identifying the kingdoms in the vision with specific historical kingdoms. And in the case then of the beasts in this vision, which as we've just seen also represent kingdoms, I'm still a little bit reluctant to go down that route because there's so much scope, I think, for unprovable speculation once you do go down that route. You know, one person thinks that this beast is this kingdom, another person thinks that that beast is another kingdom, and so on. But I think there is a little more justification for that approach here, actually, in chapter 7, partly because here the kingdoms are presented as a sequence, aren't they? Not a unit. Remember how in chapter 2 the kingdoms are presented as a unit? They are that one statue that's made up of various kingdoms. And I said, therefore, it's really world powers in general, I think, rather than specific ones, specific instances that's been represented there in chapter 2. Here, however, each kingdom is presented as a distinct self-standing entity, a distinct beast in each case. And then also it's worth saying this, that in the case of one of the beasts at least, we're given quite a lot of detail, aren't we? I'm talking about the fourth beast. And we're told about these horns that the fourth beast had, which seem to be specific kings within that kingdom. And one horn in particular, you'll notice, stands out there in verse 8. And it does all seem to be indicating then that perhaps we are being invited to give a more precise identification in the case of Daniel chapter 7. And it does seem to me a reasonable inference that this fourth beast is the Macedonian or Greek Empire, and that the horn which stands out, that's described there in verse 8, it is King Antiochus the Fourth, who reigned, as some of you will know, in the first half of the 2nd century BC. Some of the data that we have in verse 25 kind of fits with what we know about Antiochus. So the way in which he speaks words against the Most High, well, there was a definite blasphemous dimension to this Greek king, Antiochus. That's why you may know him as Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphany, as you know, is a manifestation of God, and he had that name then. There was a blasphemous dimension to King Antiochus. Or then we're told in verse 25, he shall wear out the saints of the Most High. Well, Antiochus was savage in his persecution of the Jewish people. Or then he shall think to change the times and the law. Well, Antiochus tried then to cancel and overrule various stipulations of the law of Moses. It could be a reference to that, the Sabbath law and other laws. And so then, if the fourth beast is the Greek, the Macedonian Empire, it's not that difficult to identify the preceding beasts as well. And I'm not going to make a song and dance of these identifications, but I think it's feasible at least that they are true. However, the real point is this, that all these beasts that Daniel sees are kingdoms then, they're earthly kingdoms. Whether or not we want to go too far down that route of identifying them, they're all earthly kingdoms and they're all beastly. They're all these horrible, ferocious, beastly realities. And of course, Daniel isn't receiving this vision as some neutral individual just with a general interest in history. He's receiving it as a Jew. And we're probably meant to understand, therefore, that it's particularly in relation to the Jews that these kingdoms are beastly. I mean, as we've just seen, that's explicit with regard to the fourth beast in verse 25 and also in verse 21. He made war with the saints and prevailed against them. So it's explicit with the fourth beast that it's beastly, particularly towards God's people. And that's probably what we're meant to understand with all these four beasts. They are beasts in the sense that they menace and they maul the people of God. And you might think, well, okay, then the message of this vision is a pretty simple one. It's about earthly kingdoms persecuting God's people. Well, it is, but it's about more than that, I think. Because notice the vision points, interestingly, to God's role in the whole thing. Notice that one verb that's used several times is the passive form of the verb give. So, was given, was given, was given. Verse 4, this is about the first beast, that he was like a lion and had eagle's wings. And as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And we don't need to go into the details of what that's talking about, but just to notice, was given. Well, then you move on to verse 6. This is the third beast. And we read there that it's like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Well, then you jump to verse 25, and as we've already said, this is talking about the fourth beast, and particularly that one horn, which may be King Antiochus Epiphanes. The end of the verse, they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Now you might say, okay then, we get that as well. The message of this vision is about earthly kingdoms persecuting God's people under God's sovereignty. God is sovereign over this whole affair. Well, again, that's true, but again, I think there's more to it even than that. Because look at verse 5, where it's the second beast. Behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side, it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, another passive verb, it was told, arise, devour much flesh. Told by whom? Told presumably by the same one who's doing all the giving. God. God here is depicted as actively encouraging this beast, this kingdom, to devour the flesh of his people, to attack and persecute his people. And if you think, well, not sure about that, Dan, then I think it's confirmed when you just turn over to the next book of the Bible, the prophecy of Hosea, and you go to Hosea 13. And you know, some of you, Hosea, and how it's a pretty, apart from the first three chapters, which we quite like, after that it's pretty bleak stuff. A lot of judgment being declared against God's people. They're pursuing idols. They've forgotten Yahweh. And this is one way that he pronounces his judgment against them, or predicts his judgment against them. Hosea 13, verses 7 and 8. So I am to them like a lion, like a leopard I will lurk beside the way. I will fall upon them like a bear robbed of her cubs. I will tear open their breasts, and there I will devour them like a lion, as a wild beast would rip them open. What's significant about that? Well, do you notice all four of Daniel 7's beasts are there in those two verses? Not quite the same order, but we have the lion, the leopard, the bear, and then just that general beastly one. But here it's God saying, I will come upon you, my people, in these ways, in a lion-like way, a bear-like way, a leopard-like way, a beast-like way. Which seems to me then to cast a light on Daniel 7 here, that as these beasts persecute God's people, these earthly kingdoms persecute God's people, Hosea 13 is saying God is behind it. It's actually God doing it through these earthly kingdoms. And so the message of this vision is actually about earthly kingdoms persecuting God's people as God's agents of his judgment against his own idolatrous people. And that's what I mean then by my first heading, the fire disguised. here are these kingdoms, the Babylonian kingdom, its successors, all the way down to the Greek kingdom. And on the face of things, they're just pursuing their own world-conquering agendas. That's all they're doing. Actually, through them, God's fire, chastising judgment is being directed against his own people. It reminds us, doesn't it, how powerful God is. You know, you see an old lady walking down the street and she's taking her Great Dane for a walk. But it's not quite clear as you watch who is taking whom for the walk, whether she's taking it or it is in fact taking her for the walk, this huge dog dragging her along. Well, here are these beasts, these earthly kingdoms, and God has them on a leash. And for all their ferocity, he's the one who's taking them for the walk. He's using them to fulfill his purposes, chastising, judging his people, issuing fire against his people. He's using them, these powerful beasts that you would have thought just are uncontrollable by anyone. God can control them and can use them to fulfill his purposes because we have a powerful God. And so that's the first thing, the fire disguised. Secondly, notice with me, the fire redirected. The fire redirected. Because there's an emphasis in the vision, isn't there, on a particular act of divine judgment. So in verse 9, you'll notice the Ancient of Days takes his seat. It's not suggesting that he sometimes vacates his heavenly throne. It's just a pictorial way of emphasizing that here he's going to now engage in a particular act of judgment. Verse 10, again, we have his court sitting in judgment, books being opened. Verse 22, we have this reference to the Ancient of Days coming and judgment being given. Verse 26, again, his court sitting in judgment. And so all those verses are talking about the same thing, a particular act of judgment by God. And the object of that judgment is very clear. It's this fourth beast. Verse 11. As I looked, second half of the verse, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with the fire. And particularly, actually, the horn that we've talked about, that horn that stands out, which, as I've said, may be a King Antiochus, Epiphanes. Verse 26, that horn is consumed and destroyed to the end. So we're particularly being shown here an act of divine judgment against one of the beasts. Although in verse 12 you'll notice the other beasts are also judged by God. So we're being shown in this vision these beasts, these earthly kingdoms being judged by God, the Ancient of Days. And so here are these kingdoms then. And we've seen that God gives them dominion. And we've seen from Hosea 13 that he gives them dominion in order to be the channel of his fire, his judgment against his own people. And that seems to create a problem, doesn't it? Here are these kingdoms being all beastly and bad. Well, if God is using them for his purposes, does that make their beastliness and their badness okay? Does that mean they can be bad and beastly with impunity because God is using their badness and their beastliness to fulfill his purposes? That's the problem with which Habakkuk struggles, isn't it? If you've ever read that prophecy, you'll know he just can't get his head around this. God is going to use Babylon to punish his people. Babylon in all its wickedness, all its paganism, all its idolatry, all its violence and brutality. How can that be? Does that mean that Babylon is just getting away scot-free with all of this? Well, this vision contains the answer, and it's no. Yes, God uses these bad and beastly kingdoms as the fire, as the channel of the fire of his judgment against his people, but not forever, not indefinitely. The point comes when that judgment fire is redirected. And it's redirected against these kingdoms because of their badness and their beastliness. And that's what we see happening in this vision. It's what we read of in Isaiah 10. In Isaiah 10, you have the Lord speaking to Assyria. And in Isaiah 10, verse 5, he addresses Assyria as the rod of my anger, the staff in my hands. Because the Lord has used Assyria, is using Assyria at that point, as a rod against his own people, in rather the same way we've talked about tonight. But then Isaiah 10 goes on to talk about how this rod, Assyria, have become arrogant. Verse 15, shall the axe boast over him who hews with it? And so the rod in God's hand, it had become too arrogant and was boasting in itself. And so God says in that passage, soon I'm going to turn on the rod. For the moment Assyria is my agent of judging my people, soon I'm going to redirect the judgment against Assyria. And that's exactly what we're seeing here in this vision in Daniel 7. And again then, it's an important theme for us to take on board tonight. That God will sometimes use bad agents for his good purposes, but not at the expense of his justice. No, eventually the point comes when the bad agents have to answer for their badness. That's what we're being shown in Isaiah, in Isaiah 10 and in Daniel 7. I think of my friend Adam, whom some of you have met. He spoke at our house a few years ago. Some of you came and heard him. He's from a Central Asian country and ministers to Christians from that country. And he goes to Europe and to the refugee camps in various European countries where so many have come in recent years. And he ministers to believers on those refugee camps. Many of them have just been converted since arriving in the camps. And he talks about what an amazing movement of God this is, that all these hundreds of thousands of refugees have flocked into Europe in these last years. We hear so much about it on the news, and many of them are finding Christ. They're coming from Muslim lands where they've never heard the gospel, and they're coming to our continent, and they're being converted to Jesus Christ. We don't hear that part on the news. And yet you think of all that's involved in them coming to Europe. You think of these people traffickers, these people who exploit them and take all their savings from them and say, you know, we'll give you a new life over there. We'll put you on a lovely boat, send you across the sea, you know, have a new life in the affluent lands of Europe. And so they give all their money and they're put on a cramped boat that's unsafe. And they're fortunate if they make it across, and it's wicked. And yet God is using those people traffickers to bring his elect to Europe where they'll hear the gospel and be saved. Does it mean then that the people traffickers are just getting away with it and it's fine what they're doing? Well, of course not. God is just. And so God is both using them, and also he will one day call them to account. And so it's an important principle that we have here in these Old Testament passages, a God who uses bad agents, but those bad agents do not act with impunity. So the fire disguised, the fire redirected, but then thirdly and finally this evening, the fire quenched. The fire quenched. And so we must come to verses 13 and 14 as we close, which is, I guess, the most famous part of the passage. And do notice then that it's not kind of as randomly and awkwardly stuck in the middle here as it might appear to be, especially from the ESV kind of ESV break there between verse 12 and verse 13. We have similar language used here that we've had already used So verse 13 begins, I saw in the night visions. Well, verse 7 has begun. After this, I saw in the night visions. Verse 13 goes on, behold, with the clouds of heaven. Behold, well, that's how these beasts have been introduced. Each one, behold, I saw a beast. And it was like whatever. And in fact, even that language of likeness. You know, the first beast was like a lion. One was like a bear, like a leopard. Well, verse 13, here's one like a son of man. So we have these verbal echoes in verse 13 of before. And I think we are kind at one level meant to see then that here now we have a fifth king. We've had these four kings that we've been shown. And perhaps, as I say, we can tentatively identify them. And the fourth then has been the Greek Empire. And it will pass. God will bring it down. And then there's going to be a fifth king in the sequence. And this is the fifth king. The one described in verses 13 and 14. But of course, for all the parallels, the similarities, there's also a huge amount of difference. And just two things to notice then about this king. First, his identity. Who is he then? He's called the Son of Man, or one like a Son of Man. Well, we know, don't we? We know because we've been in Matthew's Gospel these past weeks, and we've encountered this title there, on the lips of whom? On the lips of Jesus. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. This morning we saw the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. This is Jesus who would emerge after Babylon and the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks. Jesus would emerge. And it's his enthronement then that's being described here, isn't it? He comes into heaven and is presented before the throne of God. This is what we read of from the earthly side of the whole thing in Acts chapter 1. Jesus on the Mount of Olives, disappearing from the apostles' sight, going up, up, up for this enthronement. And here we're seeing the same scene from the heavenly side in Daniel 7. This is that moment of enthronement. So that's the identity. And then the other thing to notice here is the location. And what he said then, he goes into heaven. But there's a real emphasis on kind of the proximity to God here, isn't there? Verse 13. So there came one like a son of man. So there already we have this idea of him coming into the presence of God. But then it's emphasized in the next line again. And he came to the Ancient of Days. It's a different verb in the Hebrew. It's the Aramaic actually. And it means something more like reached, actually reached, attained, came right up to. And then again in the next line, and was presented before him. There's this real emphasis on proximity. And it should raise a question then. In the light of our emphasized detail tonight, verse 10. The fire. This river of fire. It's not a trickle, it's a river of fire that's before the throne. How the dickens can this person just go right up to the throne when there's a river of fire that's proceeding from out of that throne? That's what we're supposed to ask. That question should be in our minds. How can he go right up and be presented there when there's fire there? Well, we're not given the answer in Daniel 7, but we know the answer, don't we? The answer is because this Son of Man, prior to this point of enthronement, prior to being presented there at the throne of heaven, he has died on a cross outside Jerusalem, and there has quenched the fire of God's judgment, and there has swallowed it all up into himself, and there has dried that river. And that's the significance of these wonderful touches you have in the second half of Daniel 7, of him going there not alone, but going there accompanied by others and sharing this access he has and this rule he's been given with others. Verse 18, the saints shall receive the kingdom. A moment ago it was the Son of Man, but now it's the saints. And again you have it in verse 22, the saints possessing the kingdom. Again, verse 27, it's given to the dominion, which a minute ago was being given to the Son of Man, is now also being given to the saints of the Most High. And it's this wonderful picture then of the Son of Man having quenched the fire of God's judgment for a people who deserved to be under that judgment, then being able to usher them with him into the throne of God to share his status there. It's kind of, and I close with this, Old Testament pictorial, the Old Testament pictorial equivalent of that lovely scene we have in a garden at the end of John's Gospel, where you have a weeping woman, Mary Magdalene, she doesn't know what's happened to her master. The body's gone. And she suddenly encounters a stranger, one she thinks must be the gardener. And remember how the conversation goes. And she realizes who this is. This is Jesus, risen from the dead. And Jesus says to her, "Do not cling to me," John 20:17. "I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers." These are the apostles who have just failed him so miserably in the hours of his passion, who have deserted him, denied him, failed him so miserably. "Go to my brothers, say to them, I am ascending to my Father and my God." Well, he doesn't say that, does he? "I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." To these failures, to these miserable men who have been such wet blankets over the past hours, how can he say that to them? Because he's just quenched the fire of judgment that they deserve. And now he can say to them, "My access is your access. My God's your God. My Father's your Father." If you're a believer, that's what he says to you tonight. Notwithstanding the mess you've made of this past week, the sins you've committed, the ways you've let down Jesus Christ, he says to you tonight, "My God is your God. My Father is your Father. My access is your access. There's no river of fire flowing from God's throne that you need to worry about. It's a throne of grace that you may boldly approach now, because I've drunk it all. And I've reeled and I've tottered and I've staggered under the burning heat of it all. And now you may approach this throne with me." What a wonderful privilege. Amen.